What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
All medications require eligibility and prescription. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Halper Show. You can find the Katie Halper Show on iTunes, where you can rate and review us. You can find us on SoundCloud. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Patreon. And make sure you go to patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Because there you will find extended interviews and bonus interviews. On today's show, I'm giving you a free bonus episode. I'm playing some more interviews that I did at the Sanders Institute gathering in Burlington, Vermont. First, I speak to Roseanne DeMauro, the former executive director of National Nurses United and of the California Nurses Association National Nurses Organizing Committee. She's a lifelong activist. She talks to me about the ageism against Bernie Sanders, and Roseanne never holds back. Make sure that you listen to another bonus episode that I did with her and Naomi Klein, where Roseanne and I talk over drinks about the, quote, duplicitous, horrendous, calculated lies, end quote, against Sanders supporters and the accusations against us as Bernie bros. Then I speak to Abdul El-Sayed, who ran for governor in Michigan. He is a physician, and he was Detroit's health commissioner from 2015 to 2017, and he is an activist around public health and the Green New Deal. And then I speak to Maria Swart, who is the national director of the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA. Thank you so much, Roseanne, for speaking to me. Thank you so much. We met, we saw each other most recently at the Sanders Institute, and I just wanted to talk to you about what your thoughts are at post-institute gathering and looking forward to 2020.
Well, obviously, we're all jazzed coming off the Sanders Institute. It was an enormous high. I mean, it's a gathering space for, you know, a lot of progressive minds. I know that I know that Jane and Bernie wished that all of us everywhere throughout the country or throughout the globe actually could have attended that. But it was inspired. I mean, the exchange that happened that wasn't even that wasn't obvious, that was behind the scenes, was actually part of the best thing about the Sanders Institute, because everyone connected, you know, new relationships were formed, ideas were, you know, people didn't agree necessarily on all policies, but there was a really great exchange on ideas. And it was just, I mean, I think it was inspired. I loved the weekend. It was one of the few conferences that I've gone to that I wasn't ready to leave.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It felt like so, there's a real community or camaraderie or,
And then, and also I think people recognize like what, I mean, first of all, Jane Sanders, I mean, authentic, beautiful, kind, all of those things. And I think, you know, for me, I sat there kind of thinking, I can't even allow myself almost to imagine a world in which a Jane Sanders could be the first lady of this country. I mean, that's, you know, it kind of gave me chills to think about, because she's such, you know, she cares about policy deeply, kind of like a Eleanor Roosevelt, I think I said that to you, type of player potentially in the White House, but someone who actually cares about what happens to people in this country. And so then I think, you know, we all came off of that and we were all, you know, inspired to take it further and further in some ways, is, you know, from policy to politics, right? And that is, you know, draft Bernie.
Yeah.
We did this in 2016. We had a well, actually in 20, I don't know, it's 24, 2015, I think it was. Well, maybe 2014. I don't know. Way back when. We had a draft Bernie campaign. I don't know if you remember that. And so it was prior to him stepping into the, you know, into the race for the presidency. And we had a grassroots movement to draft Bernie, and it was tremendously successful. And this was before, you know, Bernie had the type of name recognition or the you know, political standing that he certainly does enjoy now. But we did a phenomenal amount of grassroots work to convince Bernie to run for president in 2016. And this reminds me in some ways of that, but we're in a very, very different dynamic now. There is no one who doesn't know who Bernie Sanders is.
Right.
And what he represents.
Yeah. And by the way, how did you first meet Bernie and Jane Sanders?
You know, I met Bernie and Jane. Well, I met Bernie first. Mm-hmm. I met Bernie when we did a single payer work when he was in, I think he was in the Senate at that point. I supported Bernie's president. I supported Bernie's run for mayor back in 1980, believe it or not, Katie.
Wow. Before I was born.
Yeah. I know. It's like, but I didn't know Bernie at point in time. Yeah. I just knew him by reputation from magazines, because there wasn't the internet
right. That
it is now. But we did work on single payer many, many years ago in the Senate. We introduced Senate bill for single payer, and we worked together on single payer when I was running the nurses union. And it was, he was exactly the same person he is now, exactly the same. And his passions were the same. That's what, you know, at the end of the day, you know that, you know, this is the person who's been consistent for 40 years and has been unwavering. And it's phenomenal. His commitments are there. But so this time the draft Bernie is coming from, some former staffs posted the site, but basically we're all in. And it's basically to say to him, you know, this isn't somebody who wants to run for president to get name recognition.
Right.
This isn't someone who's running for president to try to be important. This is someone who could be running for president to actually change the policies that affect the most vulnerable and all of us in America, to basically instill America with a set of values that takes care of its own people and make sure that we're not in international wars that'll ultimately kill us,
right.
for lack of a more delicate way to say that.
But so it's true.
I think if there's a sense, and I told you this the other night when we were talking, there's a sense of urgency at this moment in history. And so, so our new draft Bernie campaign is everyone has to tell him. If you love him, tell him.
Yeah. We love you, Bernie. This is the official official line of the Katie Halper Show. But yeah, we'll share that also.
Yes.
And you've tweeted where that is. And so people can just go to
organizingforbernie.com. Organizingforbernie.com.
Organizingforbernie.com. And
ING,
because it's action. People are already doing it.
Right.
And what about you? You posted today, I saw on your Twitter feed, which is great. You posted an image that says, "Say no to ageism." What is that about?
Well, I think it's a national disgrace that people are so horrendously that they discount the intelligence and the wisdom of someone who's older.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they're using is a narrative, and it's against Biden, too. I mean, so this isn't peculiar to Bernie, but they're using this narrative that, you know, if you have experience, somehow you're not welcome in the presidency, when in fact it is precisely what we need. Nelson Mandela became president of South Africa when he was 80. I mean, so no one this is such a shallow narrative, and it's okay. What's bad in America is that it's okay to be ageist. It's not okay any longer to denigrate people on the basis of race or gender, but on age, you can completely denigrate people, and it's like a laugh line. It's not a laugh line. First of all, it's, you know, let's just talk about older people for a second here. You know, we all age differently.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of us die at 50 in our 50s, and some of us die in our 70s, some of us die at 100. But it's all relative to kind of the human organism. So every individual, every physical individual is different. I've been with Bernie an awful lot of times running through airports, and I find it difficult to keep up with him. I mean, he's a massive, he was a cross country runner.
Right.
And I think that, you know, that's who he is. And he has that endurance, but he also, more importantly, has that wisdom. So I think that, you know, using that as a club, but I don't think it's just about Bernie. I think our country is shallow.
Yeah.
And I think it doesn't take care of people. You know, it doesn't respect people as much when, you know, they're over 60 even. I mean, women are shut out of the workforce. People who have a phenomenal amount to contribute are shut out of the workforce based upon age. That's outrageous. And so, and that narrative spills over now when we're talking about someone who has the most wisdom, the most experience to run for president of the United States, that we condescend about it. And that condescension is what's really got me angry this morning, I have to tell you, Katie.
Yeah. Was there something in particular that you saw, or is it just a general?
You know, yeah, Jimmy Kimmel did this, you know, shtick, you know, saying Beto's a baby and Joe Biden and Bernie are old. And I thought, you know what, how shallow. I mean, really, you need that for a laugh line?
Well, according to a new Harvard-Harris poll, the top choices right now are Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, and Beto O'Rourke, two old men and a baby.
Jimmy Kimmel, I mean, go get a different job if that's a laugh line to you. You don't get to be ageist. I mean, why is his network not holding him accountable that? If he was on there talking about someone based upon race or gender, it would be off. I mean, it would be so off limit. He would be, you know, it would be questionable if he could maintain his job. Yet he can rail on ageism like people are second class citizens or third class citizens because they're older. That's disgraceful. Yeah. That's not funny. That's not a laugh line. And he shouldn't enjoy that space to be able to do
that. Yeah, it's true. At least there'd be like a petition calling on him to apologize, right?
He should apologize. Yeah. It was inane. And, you know, one of these days, you know, should he be a comedian? How old is he?
Right.
He might be dated for a comedian.
Yeah, he still be laid out to pastor, right?
According to his own rules.
You yourself, you are far from retired, but I guess you're technically retired.
Yeah, I had done, you know, I mean, I had
speaking
run the
about experience and wisdom. Yeah,
yeah, I like massive experience, but I ran the nurses organization for 32 years, and I thought, you know, it's really time that I use kind of my focus to do other things. And so I really, you know, I was very certain what I wanted to do. I, you know, left a wonderful, wonderful position with wonderful people, the nurses, to actually try to work actually as part of this movement to convince Bernie Sanders to run for president. And I've been intricately involved in that, as you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm pushing the envelope on that because honestly, I look around. I mean, Springsteen said this the other day, that there's no one that he sees in the Democratic Party who can beat Donald Trump.
Right.
Now, Bernie Sanders can. I mean, the polls say that.
Yeah.
It's all indicative. But, you know, we've got, I don't think this isn't about Bernie. This is about, you know, this is personal. This is about my life and my, you know, life of my kids and, you know, and you and everyone. I mean, it's about all of us on this planet. And I kind of like the idea of saving the planet to begin with. I mean, it's just a good idea for human beings to have a planet. But, you know, I mean, right now we're at a tipping point and he's got to step up. He's got to step up. And I know he goes back and forth. You know, and I know a lot that goes on, but regardless, we have to let him know, heart and soul, we want him there.
Yeah.
He's got to be, this is, I always say, heroes aren't made, they're cornered, and he is the most cornered. I cannot think of a moment in history when someone wasn't so cornered. The Democrats have been exposed, the neocons in the Democratic Party have been exposed for what they are. They know that the working class has lost heart. They don't believe in them. They don't believe them.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. I mean, you're not going to convince somebody on the line to vote for an anointed, moneyed candidate from the Democratic Party. They can sniff it. They see it.
Right.
They feel it. The inauthenticity.
Yeah.
And this stuff about, you know, oh, they're running on Bernie's agenda. You know what? It's Bernie's agenda. So therefore, Bernie should run on his own agenda.
Right.
I mean, and honestly, I think most of them are too shallow to even get what Bernie's agenda is. They're just mimicking the words. They're parroting what he says, trying to, you know, piggyback on his fame, if you will.
Yeah.
And I don't believe it. They're not going to save us.
Right.
They're not going to save us. And we're going to be extremely vulnerable if the Republicans will win again if we don't have a real systemic change in this game. Right now, what we have is the Democrats and the Republicans are playing like a sport. You know, it's my basketball.
Right.
It's not a sport. Our lives are on the line. The planet's on the line. Our health is on the line. You know, our economic system is on the line. We don't have the luxury for this shallow discussion that goes on between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. So just like Donald Trump did in some ways, honestly, I guess we're asking Bernie to step up, step out. I mean, Trump did that against, you know, the will of his party,
right.
And he was able to carry that grassroots movement. And as much as I hate to give him credit, well, in some ways, he watched the Bernie operation and was so like, wow.
Right. I mean, he's effective. We can admit sometimes people that like self-center or they center other people. Someone who is very bad can be effective, and we have to be honest about that, right? Especially because we want to defeat him. Yeah.
We would be naive not
exactly,
to.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, he knows how to galvanize his base.
Yeah.
He does. The problem is that part of who's his base should be our base, and
yes.
They don't have an alternative in our base.
Exactly, right.
And so we need Bernie for about a thousand reasons,
yeah.
if not more. And he's got to step up. And
yeah.
so I really want people to encourage him, you know, through getting other people to, you know, go on organizingforbernie.com. And, you know, there's a Twitter site is, I think it's at OFB, that's Organizing for Bernie 2020. And, you know, go on, just engage. Bernie is not about himself. He's about the grassroots. And the grassroots, you know, I mean, if the grassroots corner him, he'll go. That's what I believe.
Right. Yeah. So there's you can also go to a Move On. There's a presidential poll. If you go to act.moveon.org and you can take place in this membership wide straw poll. That's about 2020 presidential elections.
Right.
And you were saying that there's the Twitter handle that is OFB2020, as you said, then there's
right.
the hashtag. And what about, yeah, what is this? Oh, what is he saying, by the way? I mean, I'm sure you can't reveal a lot of your behind the scenes interactions with him, but what can you say about what Sanders is saying about the possibility of running?
I don't know. He's saying, I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah. Yeah.
That's what he's saying. I mean, that is really what he's saying,
yeah.
too. But I say the opposite. He's running. You know why? Because he says, and this is, you know, true by definition, he's going to run if he's the most qualified person
right.
to beat Donald Trump. Well, he's the most qualified person to beat Donald Trump, ergo, run, Bernie,
yeah,
run.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Baby, we're born to run, to quote the boss.
Born to run. Yeah. And
Springsteen
should get on board.
I know. I was surprised he didn't.
Well, he didn't get involved in the primary. He pontificated from the sidelines this time. I mean, really. But you know what? Honestly, I don't know, you know, to what effect he had. He, you know, certainly didn't carry it for Hillary Clinton when
right.
he went on stage with her. But, you know, we've got some, you know, we've got a lot of star power in our campaign. But that star power is like a committed power. And so,
right.
you know, as you know, we were at the People's Summit. I mean, not People's Summit, sorry.
I'm both of them, back. But yeah, this recently,
yeah.
the
we're
Sanders
there too. We were there
right.
too. Yeah, the Sanders
yeah.
Institute.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, we've got a lot of star power, but actually it's the people power at that thing, the intelligence, the high-level people, thinking people,
right.
you know, committed people, people like you, Katie.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. But, I mean, also among the star power, what's so interesting is, like, look at Danny Glover and Susan Sarandon.
Yes.
I mean, these are people who have, like, been arrested. They've walked the walk. They've gone down to the South. They're not just people who are saying, like, oh, if only Trump weren't in office, we'd be brunching right now. They're
exactly.
not that brand of Hollywood.
No, they're not.
Yeah.
They're not. And John Cusack.
And John Cusack,
I mean,
right.
Yeah. I mean, you know, he's so in. It's just, yeah, I mean, so they've got that, you know, those people to amplify the message. But we are the messengers. We
yeah.
are the messengers, you know, regular people like us who are out there, people like us who are listening to your podcast.
Oh,
yeah. Who are, you know, who have good hearts.
Yeah.
And they want change for their people. And so that's where we are.
Yeah. Why is it that I feel like there's like there's a big menschiness quotient, a high menschy factor, to use the Yiddish word. And it was very moving seeing that being at the Sanders Institute. One of the most moving things was I saw Ada Colau, who's the first female mayor of Barcelona. I saw her,
right.
Fernando Haddadi, who was defeated by the total fascist torture advocate, Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, and Danny Glover. And they all like raised their they held hands and they lifted them in the air. And they had like their fists in the air. It was really emotional.
Right. Right.
But yeah, that was the thing. It's like it really is a moral call. I mean, you hear that in every issue, right? Whether it's about saving the earth and the climate or healthcare for all. It's really, there's a real moral foundation. So
it's deep. Yeah, it's very deep. When we sang Solidarity Forever, and you know, you could look out there and see, you know, the Carnell West and Bernie Sanders.
Oh yeah, Carnell West is there too. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was just, it just kind of melts you. It's like, God, we can do this. We can do this. But it's going to be a lot of work. I mean, we're going to be up against the nastiness of the Democratic Party trolls. I know that and the Republican Party trolls.
Right.
Their attempts to demoralize good reporting, good reporters, any Bernie supporters, you know, they're nasty pieces of work with these campaigns when we get into them. And they can do, you know, they try to do a lot of damage. They try to do reputation damage. And you got to really have a tough skin to get through it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, most of us are veterans at this point in time. So, you know, whatever. But for new people coming in, they just have to get their armor up because it's going to be a ride.
Right. Yeah. And any other advice that you have as someone who's been in the movement?
Yeah, I've got a lot of advice, Katie, and we should just continue talking through the campaign.
Okay, great. So this is the first installment of Ask Roseanne.
Right, exactly.
Well, thank you so much. I know you have a lot of work to do, but this is great. Thank you so much for giving us some of your time. Okay, great.
All right.
That was Roseanne DeMauro. Now I speak to Abdul El Sayed, who ran for governor in Michigan. He is a physician and activist around public health and the Green New Deal. And he was Detroit's health commissioner from 2015 to 2017. So welcome. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Yeah, thank you. I'm excited to be chatting.
Yes. Tell us what you're doing here and what you spoke about on the panel that you're on the Green New Deal.
So we're in Burlington, Vermont for the Sanders Institute gathering. It's a gathering of folks from in and around the progressive movement. And I had the privilege of serving on a panel with folks like Naomi Klein and Bill McKibben, Matt Nelson, and Stephanie Kelton, and we're talking about the Green New Deal. And my hope as a former health commissioner in the city of Detroit was to situate the Green New Deal from the perspective of a kid in Detroit. I believe that great policy always centers around real people rather than ideals or even abstract trends. And I think when we situate those people, we can understand exactly why this thing matters. And the beautiful thing about the Green New Deal is that it addresses several challenges that a kid in Detroit might be facing. The fact that we have been subsidizing large corporations like GM, who just announced that they'll be shutting down a major factory in Detroit and Hamtramck that they opened 30 years ago.
I'm going to cut some of that audio from there.
Okay.
So I'll put that in here, like right here into this part.
I just want to situate this locally in Detroit, right? Because if you want to understand great policy does the work of solving problems for real people. Oftentimes when we think about policy, we're often optimizing to an idea. We're optimizing to a trend, but not optimizing to real people. And I think if you want to understand the effects of a tree, whether it's a tree of goodwill or a tree of poison, the effects of the tree are going to be most profound at the roots. And I think the root of the various policy ideas that are packed into this Green New Deal, they sit in a community like Detroit. And I want you to imagine if you were a small child, a little girl, let's say you're 3 years old, and your mom or dad just got laid off because GM shut down a plant at the edge of Detroit and Hamtramck, 1,500 jobs lost, which, by the way, had been built over top of a community, a multi-ethnic community called Poletown, 30 years ago. They actually had to physically lift 5 women in a paddy wagon so that the bulldozers could start building at that last minute to build that plant. Now, in Detroit, the probability of being hospitalized for asthma is threefold the rest of the state. If you have mild persistent asthma, you're likely to miss at least one school day every 2 weeks. Don't you think what that is? And it's not because you got to stay home and play video games. It's because you could not breathe that morning and you had to be rushed to a hospital. And the reason why is because Detroit is the epicenter of most of the biggest carbon emitting plants in the entire state of Michigan. A Marathon Petroleum refinery probably sits within 2 miles of that three-year-old girl's home. And that petroleum refinery, they're the biggest single emitter of sulfur dioxide in the entire state. The EPA has ruled them to be in what's called non-attainment. So when we talk about the climate change epidemic, let's think about the roots. And the roots are in those communities where this climate is released, and the consequences are babies who can't go to school because they cannot breathe. And then from there, ask yourself about why GM got to build that plant that employed that kid's parent, because they got huge levels of corporate subsidies from the state, from the city, and from the federal government. And then they shut down. And by the way, because they built out of Detroit, they built the entire infrastructure of the state of Michigan around what? The car. And so there is no public transit in the city of Detroit. So the high likelihood is that that kid has to get into a car to go even 2 miles. And you know what? In Detroit, 40% of Detroiters don't have a car. The cost of auto insurance is fivefold the state average. So when we talk about a Green New Deal, the reason that this is so resonant is because it speaks to the experience of real people. It speaks to the fact that what is driving climate change is exactly that output from those plants that is poisoning those kids. It speaks to the fact that we need to rebuild an infrastructure that is clean around the experience of people who cannot get from place to place because we built our infrastructure all wrong in the post-World War II era. And it speaks to the fact that right now this corporate subsidized system of job creation has failed low-income people for the most part, either because they're underemployed or because those businesses realize that because of globalization, those companies are going to up and leave, and you cannot rely on those jobs. So that Green New Deal sits at the lived experience of that kid. And the fact of the matter is, you don't have to be in Detroit to see why this matters. Because if good policy is about situating about real people, good politics is about empowering people to see themselves in those shoes. And so when you talk to folks in Traverse City, they know about the Line 5 oil pipeline that sits in the Straits of Mackinac between Lake Huron and Lake Michigan, that if it burst would burst into 10% of the world's fresh water. They know about that. And every time there's a scare because an anchor dropped too close, they know what that would look like in their homes. They're not that kid in Detroit. They're folks who we'd call suburban or rural. When you talk to folks about PFAS in our water, or more importantly, the Flint water crisis, which is a crisis of infrastructure, which has created the poisoning, mass poisoning of children, who, by the way, happen to be low income and disproportionately black. And so I think when we talk about this issue, it's really important to ask ourselves, when we validate policy and politics, does it actually situate a real person? And is that the person suffering? And does the message actually pull people into that frame so that they can see the world from somebody who suffered? And that's the reason I think this Green New Deal has been so effective. Our campaign ran on part of it. I'm really proud that one of the key architects of the policy is my former policy director, Rihanna Gunn-Wright. You'll hear that name many, many times in the future. Incredible young African-American woman who is, I think, going to be a huge policy engine for a progressive future. But that's being erected out of a set of ideas that we actually beta tested on the campaign. Because when you sat down and you talked to suburban folks and you said, hey, look, you have to actually sit in your car 30 minutes to get to work. Do you like doing that? Most of them said no. And when you asked them about what the consequences probably were for the environment, they all understood. And they understood that the infrastructure that we had built around this entire way of life, that infrastructure was crumbling and we had not invested in rebuilding it. Instead, we were investing in giving corporate subsidies to corporations like GM so that they could up and move when they realized that it was a better bet for them to invest in China. And so I think it's really important for us to always focus our message around a policy that's focused on the people we want to serve.
I think that we have an opportunity in our politics right now to bring a level of empathy and perspective of having listened to everyone and understood.
Sorry, that was Justin Bieber speaking of empathy with his song, Is It Too Late Now to Say Sorry? It's an alarm, which I also asked for. If I can say sorry for that.
No worries.
Okay. Empathy, you were saying?
Yeah. I lived in Florida for some time, and 5 days after my little brother was born, Hurricane Andrew hit. And I remember walking out of my house, and it looked like a war had happened overnight. I was 8 years old, and I didn't quite appreciate how serious it was until I saw my dad... afraid. And, you know, when you're eight, your dad is Superman.
right? And Superman was afraid. And Superman doesn't get afraid. He puts his cape on and he goes and fights the fight, right? But Superman was very afraid. My five-day-old brother thankfully slept through the night. For me, the moments that were most meaningful in communicating to folks who didn't already have an ideological preset around this issue was about asking them to put themselves in the shoes of somebody who's had their life turned upside down, and then connecting it to a moment or a crisis that's just around the way. So for folks in communities across Michigan, the Flint water crisis was that. It was saying, imagine you had been brushing your kid's teeth and bathing your child in water that was leaded, and asking yourself every single day about whether or not the consequences of that will hurt your kid's life potential. Imagine you're one of the folks who's got PFAS in your water, and all of a sudden every year you've got to go to a doctor and get a chest x-ray because it might just be that you had cancer. Imagine being that person who lives on the coast or even close to the coast when Line 5 splits open and poisons the Great Lakes water. That's not that far away. And those are the feelings it would feel like. For me, it was being able to connect folks to that experience and having them even walk for a moment through the trauma that exists for people who've gone through that every single day, right? And when you get people close to that and you ask them to see the humanity in those people who are suffering that, they're not just the people on CNN running away from the Paradise Fire, they are you, they are your parents, they are your sisters and your brothers, they are your kids. Those are the moments where it happens for them. And once it happens for them, that's empathy, right? Once that empathy comes into the context, into the setting, then this is not a question about abstract ideas. Because again, great policy is about actually situating on people, and great politics is about getting people to see themselves in those people.
Dude, you're good at this. You gotta run for some more stuff.
And then
I think empathy is really important.
Yeah, when we frame our politics around empathy, I think it takes us beyond a lot of the outrage of this moment. And you know, fact is that outrage has a shelf life. We allow a certain individual to dominate our public conversation because we respond to everything crazy he says. And I think 2 years on, we have to get past that.
Right.
And we have to start asking, how do we be servants to the people who get left behind in a lot of his policy? That should be the point, rather than trying to get angry at him for going after and demonizing and hurting people. Let's be the folks who help them,
right,
and lift their voices. And then, yes, of course, there has to be some opposition, but that should be framed around protecting,
right,
rather than attacking. And
I agree,
I just think that makes us so much more comprehensive,
right,
and thoughtful and big in our message.
Yeah. I think that responding to tweets, for instance, it's like, I get that it's tempting, but it doesn't really solve anything. Also, I always think that a lot of people walk into his trap because this is a guy who thrives off of being maligned and attacked by the, people, regardless of where they're coming from. He can just dismiss them as the media, the establishment, whatever. And so the liberals, and which is why I think it's a useless waste of time, honestly, when we talk about what he says about women. It's disgusting, but like the people who voted for him or stayed at home don't care.
Yep.
Enough to either leave or to vote against him. And I don't mean the judgmental way of the people who, like, it's just a...
Well, just, we have to remember, as people who are heavily engaged in politics, not everybody is.
Right.
And they're the people we want to inspire.
Yeah.
And I think right now we've been playing this sort of call-out game. Look how evil he is.
God.
Look,
yeah,
how terrible,
right,
he is. And it's easy because we fall into his trap of being these attackers.
Right.
And it draws a false equivalency, but a false equivalency,
right,
he points to.
Yeah.
And I think we've got to be able to stand up on our own and say, my job as a public servant or aspiring public servant or somebody in the media space is to look out for and empower a group of people who tend to get marginalized and forgotten.
Right.
And that's a different conversation. And it starts with a frame on empathy and a perspective on always centering ourselves around the people whose voices don't get heard.
Right. So What are you doing now? Can you talk about your evolution? You were a Rhodes Scholar, you went to med school, you were going to practice medicine, and then what happened?
So I wanted to be a surgeon, and I wanted to work in sub-Saharan Africa where there are not many surgeons. And I want to do that because growing up, my family is ethnically Egyptian. I would spend a lot of my summers with my grandmother, who is the smartest person I've ever met, but who never got to go to school. And she would always remind me, she said, never look down on any of your cousins who never had the opportunities I had. But remember, you owe a lot more because of the circumstances in which you grow up. And then my stepmom, who raised me, is a daughter of the American Revolution. And so I used to live between these very different sort of American experiences.
Yeah.
And I thought I wanted to do something about health inequalities that I would see, and came to appreciate that the inequalities that I had watched happen on that 8-hour journey between here and in Egypt, or here in any country in sub-Saharan Africa, I could drive 30 minutes from where I grew up into a neighborhood in Detroit and travel the same 10-year life expectancy gap. So I really wanted to solve health inequalities at home. And then as a training physician, came to appreciate that the ability to actually do that within the system was very limited. And so I decided not to do a residency. I also did a PhD in public health at Oxford during my Rhodes Scholarship. And so turned my attention to public health research. And I thought, as a public health researcher, I could elucidate policies that would address health inequities, and came to appreciate that academia is its own system and sometimes very divorced from the problems on the ground. And so left academia when I got the opportunity to rebuild Detroit's health department that had been shut down when the city was facing bankruptcy and emergency management, and took on the job of rebuilding this department basically from the ground up. I mean, when I started, we had 5 city employees and 85 contractors in the back of the building where people pay parking tickets, and ultimately left it with 220 employees overall across 4 different campuses, having worked to provide every child a free pair of glasses, stood up to some of the biggest polluters in the state of Michigan, and made sure our kids weren't drinking leaded water in their schools. But also realized the hard truth of how politicians make decisions about what even matters, and was working for a mayor who shuts off water on 17,000 homes in the city of Detroit every year. And, you know, realizing that a lot of the programs the city was running weren't in the best interest of the public's health. Watched Flint happen just 50 miles north in a city where my grandmother grew up. And then watched the current president get elected. And I had to ask myself what my responsibilities were, and that's when I decided to run for office. Ran a strong campaign, unfortunately split votes with a guy who spent $11 million of his own money running on my message, who'd taken giddy selfies with Marco Rubio. But, it is what it is, and helped to move the conversation to the left. And now thinking a lot about what's next, and working on a book, which I'm really excited about, and trying to really frame the progressive movement around a politics of empathy.
Mm-hmm. So, can we talk a little bit about what happened with the election? I mean, what the takeaways from that, and things like that can be prevented?
Yeah, well, look, rich people who want power often use their money for power, and there was no difference here. This is a guy who saw that the progressive message was ascendant, and so decided to call himself progressive despite having maxed out to John McCain, despite having taken selfies with Marco Rubio in Iowa.
I mean, I've taken selfies to people like that, but very ironically.
Yeah.
And I don't donate to McCain.
This guy was really was really excited about
right,
a selfie.
Right, yeah.
Voted for Rick Santorum in the 2012 primary. So ran on a message that wasn't his, but had $11 million to spend, bought a Super Bowl ad, and outspend us more than 2-1, end up spending $53 a vote. But it split votes. The more centrist Democrat who ended up winning and ultimately winning the election, we endorsed her after the primary. But, she took 50% of the vote. And you can imagine if it was just she and I, it would have been a different race.
Right.
And came up against the hard truths of how the Democratic machine can work to support their favorites. They planted a story about an eligibility question that ultimately was nothing. I went to medical school in New York and voted for Barack Obama in New York in 2012. And you can have multiple voter registrations, you just can't exercise them.
Right.
And their argument was that, by definition, I should have lost my Michigan voter registration, which is just not legally true.
Right.
But we're able to get a number of lawyers from within that machine to attest to this to the press. And so 5 anonymous lawyers and...
That's always great when they're all anonymous.
And a small news outlet decided that I might not be eligible. Mm-hmm. And so pushed the story. And for 4 months before the Bureau of Elections ruled that I was, I had to work against the question of whether or not I was even eligible for the job that I was running for.
Right.
And that did some pretty serious damage to us. But look, at the end of the day, it is what it is. I'm not bitter about these things. I just believe that.
Well, it's good. But there are things that are important to note, right? Because so we understand how the media works, how narratives work, and how we need to push back against them, and money and politics and all that. Yeah, and then there was a discussion about whether you were like ethnically appropriate,
yeah.
Right?
Well,
which came from people who call themselves progressive.
Yeah, very rarely would anybody tell me I can't vote for you because you're Muslim, but
right.
They would say we worry whether or not you can win in the general because you're Muslim, so we can't vote for you.
Right.
And second order racism is still racism.
Right. Yeah. Of course. Yeah.
And when you use somebody else's racism as a shield. Around your own bias, it's still racism. At some point, it doesn't. That's not the point to me. The point to me is that we've got a responsibility to fight on our values, and I think we moved the conversation tremendously. And I'll be back at it someday.
Yeah.
I knew what it might be like to run with a name like Abdul El Sayed.
Right.
We also elected a
president named.
That's true.
Barack Hussein
That's
Obama,
right?
Right?
And yeah. I think there's always a potential for movement, and that's the thing this country's about, right? We've always been about calling ourselves to our highest truth, and I hope that I contributed to that, and certainly contributed to the debate in Michigan about what progressive politics and policy could look like, and learned a lot in the process, and also really showed that, you know, with a name like Abdul El Sayed and being unapologetically Muslim American, I could win 340,000 votes, and so we're just getting started.
Yeah, and without the backing of all the establishment and the media, and of course, I mean, we saw something kind of gross happen with Keith Ellison. And speaking of Flint and Obama, did you see the Michael Moore documentary?
I did.
I consider myself a fairly informed critic of Obama from the left. Obviously, I had no idea about that when he went to Flint.
Yeah,
and like. That was really heartbreaking, and I guess shouldn't have been surprising, but was kind of surprising. How do you think the failure of the Democrats has, and I know you're more on the positive and empathetic, but just from a cynic who is empathy-driven but thinks that some things need to be addressed, how do you think, like, what are the steps, or can you connect the dots between how, when the Democrats fail, someone like Trump is... enabled.
Yeah, make no mistake. I have my frustrations with our politics, and I'm not afraid to air them. And my criticisms come from a responsibility toward the people that we all collectively ought to serve, and our failure to often do that. Look, when Democrats buy into an ideology that says that we all ought to focus on the well-being of corporations rather than the well-being of real people. When we forget what suffering looks like, then we make mistakes. And it's easy for folks who aren't reading op-eds and who aren't watching the news to look and say, well, you're all the same because all of you have failed.
Right. That was Abdul El Sayed. Now I speak to Maria Swart, National Director of the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA.
Hello, welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Katie Halper. I'm really excited to be interviewing Maria Swart, who is the National Director of the Democratic Socialists of America. You may know them as DSA. Maria, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming and speaking to us. And I just want to put it out there, everyone. Her name is pronounced Swart. It is spelled with a V, but that's apparently silent in the Danish from which it comes. So tell us about how you became involved in the DSA.
So I actually came out of DSA's campus wing. I was a national co-chair of the Young Democratic Socialists of America. I became a socialist when I was a college student, and I was a feminist activist, and I saw an event about socialist feminism, which resonated with me because I felt that the mainstream feminist movement didn't speak to the experience of my mother and my grandmother's. So I had an epiphany at this event about socialist feminism. I realized capitalism was a system, and I had a language to explain all this unfairness that I had seen in the world.
So before that, did you identify as a feminist? Did you feel like you were compatible with some elements of feminism? What was your relationship to feminism?
Yeah, so growing up, my parents were liberal activists, and I'm biracial, and my father was in a union. Much of my extended family were in a union. So the idea of collective action was not foreign to me. Mm-hmm. And the reflection of that was becoming a feminist activist. And certainly many things about feminism resonated, but I became more and more dissatisfied as I realized that it was a limited form of feminism. I didn't understand why.
Right.
Until later.
So what is it about socialism that you find makes feminism, the fuller feminism that you identify with and that represents more women and people? Mm-hmm.
So women are half the population, and yet the mainstream feminist movement really reflects the interests of white, middle class, and upper class women, among other characteristics.
Right.
And it's just a limited understanding. Further, being a socialist feminist, you understand that there are collective solutions to collective problems, and individual solutions will not work because you just have all this pressure on you as an individual, and you're inside a system that tries to tell you that you have an individual solution, but it's inherently impossible to actually solve your problem. So it's both understanding that we're in a system, understanding the interests of working class women are different than upper class women, and also realizing the solution is only collective action.
So it's not in Hillary Clinton's pantsuits. It's more in, in other words, which is more important? Here's a quiz. Hillary Clinton's pantsuits or the women of Honduras and Libya?
Right.
Okay, it's one of the, so I get it now, I think.
Not going to go with the pantsuit.
Not going to go with the pantsuit, right. How do you see identity politics weaponized against the left and socialism in general?
Well, you look at Bernie Sanders, the most popular politician in the country, and yet people that support Bernie are called Bernie Bros.
Right.
You look at DSA, I am a Latina, I'm leading the organization, and there are many women of color in leadership, and yet we are characterized as a bunch of Bernie Bros.
Right. I reappropriated the term, by the way.
Yes.
I identify as a feminist Bernie Bro.
That's great. I just that a whole narrative may be rooted in some critiques that are valid, but it is used, weaponized to completely sweep everything else away, all of the economic analysis away. So it really erases my work and other women and people of color in leadership.
Right.
So we constantly have to push back against that.
Right. And the irony, of course, is that the things that the people who weaponize identity politics against the left claim to care about is erasure. And what they're doing, of course, is erasing the very people of color and women who are to the left of whatever.
Anything to avoid a class analysis.
Right. Anything to avoid a class analysis. So what can we do to push back on that?
Well, it's really important to point out you can't understand class without understanding gender and race and all of these things, and vice versa. So, how can you possibly understand, for example, the life experience of my grandmother, who is an undocumented Mexican immigrant, without understanding, the much bigger picture? The whole systems of our society, whether it's white supremacy or xenophobia or capitalism, they all intersect. And we need to talk about the complexity of that reality all the time. And we have to push back against lean-in feminism, mainstream feminism, all the time. It's a constant struggle.
And what do you think the relationship between, let's say, Bernie Sanders and DSA and the left at large is?
Well, during his campaign, which we will forever owe him a debt of gratitude, we as in the collect, all of us, he reintroduced democratic socialism to mainstream American political discourse. He opened the door to millions of people finding out about democratic socialism, realizing their feeling the world was not fair was actually, there was a reason for that. They were not imagining things. So in his campaign, he talked about how we needed a mass, politically aware, grassroots organized movement. And so what we think of ourselves in DSA is the democratic socialist part of that movement, and really trying to not just continue spreading these ideas, but also giving people a place where they can go and organize collectively around these ideas and continue spreading them. but also, you know, really building institutions and communities, because one of the things that we don't see enough of in our society today are institutions rooted in communities, and capitalism really pulls us apart from each other. It undermines community institutions and our social ties, and we see our chapters as one place to not only go into a community, but through that community have the strength to fight and be building collective struggle.
I find myself personally, I'm always protecting, I'm just going to be honest, Sanders, because there's so many disingenuous attacks against mm-hmm. him by people who are fine with the neoliberal and often overtly racist and sexist either statements or positions of the people they defend. Look at what Hillary said the other day about how Europe needs to, you know, curb immigration. Mm-hmm. And those same people celebrate her as a woke, you know, yes mm-hmm. queen. And Sanders is the alleged bigot. So I'm always defending him. But then, like, from a position of support, what do you think Sanders needs to do to make it clearer that race, gender, and class are connected, and that his policies are about racial justice and about gender justice? Mm-hmm. Like, do you have any tips, like friendly tips?
Friendly tips. I think Bernie definitely has learned how to communicate with so many people in this country that are deliberately ignored by the ruling class. His policies are really good policies. Right. There's a reason he's the most popular politician in the country.
What I think you and I agree on is that his policies are the anti-racist, the anti-sexist, mm-hmm. the progressive policies. But yes, sometimes the translating of yep. that is a challenge, right?
Yep.
And so especially like given how much the media pounces on him, and someone said the other day, it's almost a miracle how few mistakes he makes, given that everyone is always covering it for him.
In order to defend himself, he has to become more comfortable with that. And the only way to do that is to talk with folks that are on the front lines of those struggles.
Right, and make it more explicit, mm-hmm. right? So any other words of advice for the movement, for DSA, for feminism, for people out there watching this?
I'd say, you know, I think that most of us have the right instincts, which is in this moment, we really need to be building a mass movement, whether that's building our unions, building community organizations. We can't rely on the courts to defend us. We haven't for a very long time, but it's particularly bad now. We can't rely on Congress to save us. We can't rely on legalistic solutions. We can't rely on the Democratic Party. So we need to be organizing in ways where we can really interrupt the way society functions. That's our only source of power right now. The Democrats are going to pursue these legalistic avenues, talking about corruption. And we all know that Trump is super corrupt,
right.
but that's not going to inspire a mass movement.
Yeah, exactly.
They won by running on material issues,
right.
things like Medicare for All, and they need to continue fighting. I mean, Democrats need to pass a bunch of things in the House and then send them to the Senate for the Republicans to vote against. And meanwhile, all of us need to be organizing in the streets.
So what will the official role be of the DSA? How do you manage? Because you guys have kind of a parallel structure, right? You work with campaigns, you work outside of campaigns. So what would it be with Sanders if and when, if he runs?
So we are a very bottom-up organization, and our members decide what we're going to do in 2019 and 2020. So our members will have an organization-wide conversation about what that should look like, and depending on what happens and current events, the members will decide. It's a truly democratic organization, which is wonderful because we can actually respond to current events and develop people's critical thinking skills. And because we're run by members and we're funded by members, members really decide the direction and therefore are very invested in carrying it out.
Great. Well, I heard Bernie talking with Paul from The Real News. He said something had chutzpah, which is Yiddish for like nerviness. And so there's Shonda, which is a shame. And I would say you guys are a mitzvah, a good deed for the world and for the left and for all the disenfranchised people. So thank you so much, Maria.
Thank you for that.
And to hear more of my interview with Maria Swart, please become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. You can find me on Twitter at KTHalps, that's letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S. You can find my co-host Gabe on Twitter at Gabe_Pacheco. You can use the hashtag KTHalpshow, that's letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S-H-O-W. You can find The Katie Halper Show on iTunes, where you can rate and review us. You can find us on SoundCloud. You can find us on Facebook. See you next week.
If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.